Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Listening to Hollywood Time Machine with Alicia Mayer, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Tonight on the Hollywood Time Machine, we travel back to 1933 to talk about the rediscovery of a lost MGM short starring Larry, Moe, and Curly. And then it's on to 1939 for a look at one of the most enduring films of the studio era as it turns 75. And finally, we jump ahead to 2014 for a visit with Turner Classic Movies to talk about bringing classic film fans together for real-life experiences around the country. This is Will McKinley in New York, and now, here's your Time Machine pilot. She's an author, classic film historian, and member of one of film's founding families. Live from Sydney, Australia, it's Alicia Mayer.
Thank you, Will, and hello to our wonderful listeners.
Hello, listeners. How are you tonight, Alicia?
I am well, thank you. And it's not tonight. Remember, I'm ahead where we're all billionaires and nobody pays taxes. And right. You're back in the past.
How are you at this indeterminate hour of the day or night? So I wanted to start with a couple follow-ups to last week's show. We talked about the TCM Classic Film Festival with Kelly Kitchens last week, and unfortunately no dates have been announced yet for that, so keep refreshing your computer screens and smartphones and tablets and whatever else you use to access the internet. Also, tons of classic TV anniversaries happened this week. But perhaps the biggest is Gilligan's Island. The three-hour tour has been going on now for 50 years. And our friend Terry Connote has a great piece on the history of the show at his site. That's mercury.blogspot.com, spelled M-E-R-C-U-R-I-E. Also, we had Josh Mankiewicz on the show last week, and we talked about the Joseph Mankiewicz retrospective at the New York Film Festival. That starts this Wednesday at the Alice Tully Hall at Lincoln Center with a screening of All About Eve, introduced by Rosemary Mankiewicz. And at the time of this recording, the tickets are still available, so check that out if you're in the New York area. Also, Christina Rice last week discussed two of Ann Dvorak's best films, Howard Hawks' Scarface and also Three on a Match, both from 1932. Both coincidentally aired last night on TCM, and they're available to stream for the next 7 days on the Watch TCM app, and that's free for viewers in the United States, so check that out until October 4th. Also, Mary Mallory's report on the San Francisco Silent Film Festival's Silent Autumn event is now up at ladailymirror.com, so check that out. And finally, you all may remember our call-in segment last week. Do you remember that, Alicia?
I do remember it. It was so wonderful.
It was definitely a thing of beauty.
But confusion?
Beauty and confusion. So we're going to try that again tonight. There are a couple of ground rules. First of all, if you've already won, you're ineligible. So that rules out anybody named Christy. Sorry, ladies. Second, when you call in, turn down your computer speakers or we'll all end up in like an infinite feedback loop that will destroy the space-time continuum. And finally, if you work for the show, don't call in and try to win. My apologies to the lovely and talented Casey for unceremoniously kicking her off the broadcast last week. But we don't want LA Talk Radio to lose their FCC license.
No, we don't.
So, Alicia, I hear that George Burns is in trouble. Can you tell us about that?
I can. And listeners and Will, I need you to step into the time machine. We're going to dial back to 1938. 1938 was quite the year. It was an amazing year for entertainment. A lot was happening, but it was a pretty disturbing year for the world as we watched Hitler storm into Czechoslovakia. We were beginning to get reports of people being plucked off the streets and summarily executed. We knew that things were getting bad, but of course we had no idea how bad it was going to be. People were talking about this around the dinner table, and I'd like to take you right now to a swanky Park Avenue apartment, New York City, of course, and we are sitting around the table with Supreme Court Justice Edgar Lauer and his wife Elma, and really the cream of the crop, New York's elite. But there's one guy there who doesn't belong, and this is the shady, quote-unquote, diplomat, Albert N. Chaparro. Now, it's hard to understand what he was doing there or how Elma even knew him, but what we do know was that Chaparro was handy. He was handy because he was smuggling in amazing jewelry and other fabulous items for Elma Chaparro, because she lived a life of incredible luxury, of course. But she wasn't paying duty, so she wasn't paying customs tax, and this suited her down to a T. Now, what happened at this dinner table this particular night is that discussion turned to Hitler, and naturally there was a lot of concern voiced. All of a sudden, the maid standing in the corner, Rosa Weber, stood up, cleared her voice, and said to everybody, "I love the Führer. He is the best thing that's ever happened to Germany," etc., etc. After everybody recovered from the knocked over glasses and the dropped cutlery, she was fired on the spot by Justice Lauer. She packed up, she went outside, but she did not go lightly, because the very next day she actually plotted revenge. And she went in to the authorities and she told them all about what Elma Lauer was doing. The next thing you know, the investigation of this really turned from the apartments of New York City to the sun-kissed mansions of Beverly Hills. And guess who got wrapped up in that, Will?
You tell me.
George Burns. And
no
Jack
way.
Benny, yes. And if you did your homework, listeners, and had a look at the photo that I posted, you'll see this fantastic photo of George Burns, Gracie Allen, George E. Stone, Joe E. Brown, the man of a thousand faces, and Harpo Marx's beautiful wife, and my grandmother Mitzi sitting up in the top left-hand corner. She went to all of these parties. Well, their life was blown apart. And the next thing that happened was that George Burns, Jack Benny, were indicted for smuggling, 1938. And everything was on the line. And Hollywood held its breath. And in the end, I can tell you the end if you'd like, but in the end, Elma Lauer went to jail, Chaparro went to jail, and thankfully for us, our heroes, George Burns and Jack Benny, did not do time, but they paid some fairly hefty fines. And that is the story, my friends, from 1938.
That's a great story. And that piece is available on your blog, correct?
That is on my original blog, HollywoodEssays.com. You'll be able to read a little bit more about this, because there is another twist, and I'll leave you to read that yourselves, listener.
Very good. So let's get to our first guest. Our first guest is the writer of the classic film blog Speakeasy, and she joins us today from Waterloo, Canada. Christina Dion, thank you so much for being on the Hollywood Time Machine.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be with you, and thanks for the idea of the show. It's something that us classic movie fans really need.
Thank you so much, Christina. We are delighted that you've joined us. You know, one of the unfortunate things about covering classic film and TV is that we are sadly losing many of the folks whose work we still enjoy today. And this week has been another tough week in that regard. Can you fill us in?
Yes. Well, let's start with Don Kiefer, who died at 98. He was an accomplished stage actor, a founding member of the Actors Studio. busy on TV for a number of decades, and his movie credits included things like The Caine Mutiny, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Creepshow, The Janitor, for my generation, I remember that, Liar, Liar. But probably most memorably for all that, he was turned into a jack-in-the-box by Billy Mumy on the Twilight Zone episode.
An episode that still gives me nightmares many, many years later.
Just because he wants to play his Perry Como record. So that's then we had, unfortunately, Polly Bergen, who is 84, a wonderful singer, which might be my favorite thing that she did, actually. But a very multi-talented woman, a TV and stage actress. Emmy winner for playing Helen Morgan, which used her singing talents. And she also was a businesswoman. She started a cosmetics and a jewelry companies, and the cosmetics company was later sold to Fabergé. She also wrote advice books on beauty and fashion, I guess what today we would call life hacks to, you know, how to get ahead looking young. And of course, everybody would know her mainly from Cape Fear, where she was Gregory Peck's wife.
Right.
I loved her in Move Over, Darling, the Doris Day movie, as James Garner's second wife on the honeymoon. That was hilarious. She was great in that. And she was the first female president in Kisses for My President.
With Eli Wallach as the Banana Republic dictator, right?
Yeah. And also Audrey Long, which might, I don't know if that's a familiar name, but she was seen, she was 92. She was a classy blonde that worked her way through a number of B-movies in the 40s. Probably her biggest box office hit would be the John Wayne movie, Tall in the Saddle, where she was playing an heiress to a ranch, and she was a rival to Ella Rains, and she needed Duke's help to solve the mystery of who killed her uncle. But even more than that, though, that was her biggest hit. In 1947, she had two noirs that are really well known today. Born to Kill, where she was the innocent woman that Lawrence Tierney married so he could get closer to her sister, Claire Trevor. And then she was that same year in Anthony Mann's Desperate, where she was on the run with her husband, played by Steve Brody.
So and also yesterday we lost the Dark Shadows writer Sam Hall at 93. He wrote more than 300 episodes of the television show Dark Shadows and co-wrote the 1970 feature film House of Dark Shadows and the sequel Night of Dark Shadows in 1971. A great figure in the lives of many Dark Shadows fans like myself. And also, Christina, I know that first of the month is coming up on Monday. So real quick, we have – what are the highlights of TCM in October?
Well, October, obviously, meaning Halloween, lots of horrors. So they are running ghost movies. That's the spotlight for the scary stuff every Thursday, every manner of ghost movies. But there's also an Africa spotlight, which goes on every Friday. And that's going to be covered looking through politics, women, and Bogey, who is a category unto himself. and I know Ben Mankiewicz picks Bogey Sahara, which is on right away in the first week, which I second that. That's a fantastic film. Star of the Month is Janet Leigh. So every Wednesday we get to see her movies. Obviously, Psycho, but, you know, she has a lot of must-see films. Touch of Evil, Act of Violence, My Sister Eileen. The Naked Spur is a big one, and you can see her with her family. They have the epic The Vikings with Tony, and The Fog they're showing with Jamie Lee. So,
and how fantastic!
So you can see the whole range. And then there are other little spotlights with Lorraine Day, Richard Dix movies, that should be interesting, Edgar Elmer, Montgomery Clift, that's Martin Scorsese's pick that day. And on the 6th, they are showing a lot of animated short films. That should be fantastic as well.
And I understand that on your blog you do reviews of DVD and Blu-ray releases. Any new ones that have caught your eye?
Well, this past week there was the Criterion of Deborah Carr and the Innocents, which is one of the greatest, I guess, supernatural ghost, or is it a ghost or not, a supernatural tale. Absolutely gorgeous movie. They had a couple westerns out from Olive Films, Distant Drums with Gary Cooper, and South of St. Louis with Joel McRae. Warner Archive put out a really nice group of 30 rare films with George Arliss as the man who played God, where he, that was actually remade later on with the Liberace movie, Sincerely Yours, so that's your opportunity to see the original of that.
And actually, Christina, the big release that we're focusing on this week from Warner Archive is Classic Shorts from the Dream Factory, Volume 3, which, Alicia, includes four shorts directed by your uncle, correct?
Yes, that's right. Jack Cummings directed Plain Nuts, 1933, Beer and Pretzels, also 1933, Nursery Rhymes and Hello Pop, all 1933, and Technicolor. And really, it was the start of what became a wonderful career at MGM. Uncle Louis put him in the shorts department, and then he went on from there and had, you know, a 20-year career with MGM and many iconic films.
That's excellent. So, Christina, what do you have coming up that listeners should look for on your blog?
Well, actually, in 1 week from today, from October 4th through the 9th, I'm co-hosting with Silver Screenings blog. We have the O Canada blog-a-thon, which has an amazing lineup of sites that are going to cover every aspect of Canadian movie settings, stars, movie makers, and guess who's included? Alicia Louis B. Mayer will be one of those spotlighted.
Excellent. So we'll look for that on hqofk.wordpress.com, correct?
That's right. Yes.
And folks, you can follow Christina at hqofk on Twitter. And Christina, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure to be here, and I wish you much success with the show.
Thank you, Christina.
I am very excited for our next segment, Will. We have got two guests coming aboard the Hollywood Time Machine. First, Ron Hutchinson is a film historian specializing in the period when movies were just learning to sing and talk. And then Paul Brennan is a film collector and cinema consultant right here in Sydney, who I've met. We've had coffee. Ron and Paul, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, Ron, we'll start with you. Our first guest mentioned the Warner Archive release of Hello Pop, which had been considered a lost film for many years. How was it lost, and how was it rediscovered?
Well, Hello Pop had the distinction of being the one lost Three Stooges film of all their films at MGM and later Columbia. And there was a big fire at MGM in the mid-1960s, and it claimed several hundred films, most of which are still lost today, London After Midnight, The Rogue Song, which was a color film that had Laurel and Hardy in it, many, many Our Gang comedies and so on of the 20s. And so that was the only known print, and for all that time, it was just considered to be kind of a hopeless cause that anybody would ever find or see it. And then about a year and a half ago, I was contacted by a fellow whose friend was a film collector just outside of Sydney, and the email simply said, we have a film we think is important, we think might be lost. It's called Hello Pop. And I was pretty sure it was indeed the lost film, but we confirmed it. And we were able to make quick arrangements, first of all, with the fellow I call the film hunter Dundee, Paul Brennan, who's on with us today, who has done some wonderful work in Australia. And he actually was able to work with the collector, get the highly flammable nitrate film to the FedEx office for special packaging, getting it to Warner Brothers in early last year, and getting it preserved and restored and seen again. And as you mentioned, it just came out, ironically, this week on Warner Archive with some of the other Jack Cummings directed Three Stooges MGM shorts.
That's terrific, Ron. And, you know, not only did he help to get it out there, he actually sat with it on a bus in Sydney. I'm going to have to speak for Paul because for whatever reason he can't seem to join us at the moment. But I understand he sat with the nitrate on his lap in a bus in Sydney, and you can't actually just post or mail nitrate. But I think the question we all have is, how did it get lost? How does something get lost? And in this case, this particular film, how was it lost?
Well, with the fire at MGM, of course, that destroyed the only known print, but the way it got to Australia is very interesting in that Australia had a ravenous appetite for Hollywood films, and pretty much every release from every major studio, most minor studios, went physically to be shown in theaters throughout Australia.
Yes.
However, it was so expensive, it was not cost-effective to ship the prints back. So what went to Australia stayed there, and then in the early 1960s, the film storage facilities, which were called film exchanges, decided we don't need this old stuff anymore. So they started to put them in garbage trucks and ship them out to the landfills for burial. And fortunately, the collector that had Hello Pop and several of his counterparts, whether they paid off or convinced the garbage men to stop off at their house and unload, a lot of the film was actually stored at, in the collector's homes for these 40 or 50 years since. And that's how Hello Pop and who knows what else in Australia might have been saved that is long gone in the U.S.
So who knows what else? Who does know what else? Are there potentially more lost films in Australia?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that Paul's going to be doing is visiting some of the other collectors who either have passed on or who were in their mid-80s who were part of this salvaging getting the films detoured from the landfill. And some are in the Melbourne area and some are in the Sydney area. Nobody's ever gone through these collections, so the potential for finding some other lost American films is huge, I think.
And tell us about the Vitafoam project. I know that you're heavily associated with that. I noticed your many wonderful posts on Facebook. Can you tell us what that's about?
Sure. When sound, after many, many failed efforts in from the beginning of motion pictures to make films talk, in the early 1920s, finally a few things came together: the microphone to allow recording naturally, the ability to fill a theater by loudspeaker with sound before they used these little horns that didn't really work. And then finally, some star power in the form of Al Jolson. Everything really technically started to come together, but the sound in the system that the Warner Brothers adopted with Bell Labs was called Vitaphone, where the soundtrack was not on the film, as we're used to today, but was on a separate 16-inch shellac disc turning at 33 and a third, and it played for one reel of sound, and there was a precise starting spot for the film in the projector and a precise starting spot with a little arrow on the record to put the needle. And you threw the switch and one motor drove everything. So as long as the needle didn't jump or the film didn't break, everything did stay in synchronization. So our project decided about 20 years ago when we formed it, there were a lot of films that had no sound. The picture portion survived, but there was no sound. So the search went on for searching out for these soundtrack discs. So when you found the disc to match the mute film, a preservation was possible. And in the ensuing 23 years, we found, believe it or not, over 4,000 of these discs in private hands. And we worked very closely in, I think, a very unique partnership between private collectors, the studios, mainly Warner Brothers, the archives, and our project to restore. We've restored and been involved with restoring over 125 early shorts, mostly vaudeville and band and comedy, and actually 10 features that were done in that format.
That's amazing. And now, Ron, I do believe this makes you eligible for sainthood in the Catholic Church. Are you?
In any church, Jewish church as well.
Right. I hope you're Catholic.
Nice thing anybody said to me today.
but so it's great that all these things are restored, but are people able to see them?
Yes. One of the neat things, first of all, I think a lot of your listeners know Warner Brothers is probably preeminent in preserving and their vintage films and also getting them out, certainly through TCM, but also through Warner Archive, which has, believe it or not, put out over 200 Vitaphone shorts of the 20s and 30s on DVD. There's the Jazz Singer set has 24, but they have many, many volumes with just the shorts, and more, certainly more to come. So it's very easy to just go to the Warner Archive site and actually see what they have in terms of these shorts and other early films.
And that's great. And now have you fully exploited all the available film and discs? Are we done with the Vitaphone project?
You know, you're never done. Keep in mind, if I hear from somebody, say in China or France or, you know, down south or wherever, I have these five discs, and the first thing I do is I check to see if any of those match existing film that's still looking for sound. So every time one of those happens, another restoration is possible. There's still probably about another 40 shorts for which both the picture and sound are known, and then eventually we'll get to those for restoration. There's currently 53 shorts from 1926 to 30 that are in the restoration pipeline as we speak, and also some other non-Vitaphone early talkie films that we're working on. So I have to say, you know, every time we think things are slowing down, they just pick up.
And as you say that, millions of listeners pull out their credit cards getting ready to put them in WarnerArchive.com. But I've been to a lot of your Vitaphone screenings at Film Forum here in New York over the years. Mm-hmm. Do you have any public screenings coming up that listeners can attend?
Yes, actually, probably one of the most exciting things is Colleen Moore, who was one of the biggest stars of the 20s, a real flapper, flaming youth type star. They got paid $12,500 a week back then. Her last two silent films, which had a Vitaphone soundtrack with music and sound effects, no talking, were thought to be lost for 80 years, and they were found about 8 years ago, and they were just restored. And they were the two films, Why Be Good and Synthetic Sin, which are terrific titles, were shown. One was shown in Los Angeles. Why Be Good will be shown in October at the Chicago International Film Festival, and I'll be showing both of the films at Film Forum the first two weekends of November.
And, excellent.
November 9th and 10th, and also Synthetic Sin will be followed the following weekend, the 16th and 17th.
Excellent. I will be there. Ron, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, terrific. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Okay,
take care.
Okay, bye-bye there.
Hollywood Time Machine is brought to you this week by The Dark Pages. Take a walk in the dark and into the world of classic film noir. Can you recite the lines from Double Indemnity? Do you rave about the light and shadow in Out of the Past? Then The Dark Pages is for you. Every bi-monthly issue brings you actor bios, movie reviews, analysis, and opinion on noir history and influence, plus giant theme issues, quotes, photos, tips on what to watch, and more. Produced by a mob of great writers and edited by Karen Hansberry, author and noir authority, it's the original and premier read for noir movie fans. Available in both paper or convenient e-version, subscribe today and don't be left out in the light. Visit allthatnoir.com. And if you'd like to be an advertiser on Hollywood Time Machine, just connect with us on Facebook or Twitter. And now, time for our next guest. 2014 marks the 75th anniversary of Gone with the Wind, producer David O. Selznick's Academy Award-winning Civil War epic. We have two authors joining us to discuss the film tonight. Kendra Bean is the author of Vivian Lee, An Intimate Portrait, and John Wiley Jr. is co-author of Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind, a bestseller's odyssey, and the forthcoming book, The Scarlet Letters, The Making of the Film Gone with the Wind. John, thanks for joining us.
Certainly. Thank you for having me.
Hi, John. I understand Kendra hasn't joined us yet, so allow me the honor of the first question. There was a fascinating NPR piece that aired this week suggesting that Gone with the Wind may not have aged gracefully, but from your work and from the devotion that we see, I'm sure that you beg to differ.
Absolutely. I think certainly some young people don't seem to have the love for it that many of us who grew up with it did.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if they give it a chance, see the movie, read the book, you just cannot help but be caught up and swept away by it.
Well, John, did you listen to the NPR piece? Did you see it?
I did not hear it, but have read the transcription.
Okay, basically they spoke with 13 film students at Georgetown, and only two had seen the film all the way through. And one of them sort of, you know, kind of summarily dismissed it, you know, as being dated and you know, glorifying slavery. I mean, is there a danger of what we might call retroactive political correctness in people's assessment of a movie like Gone with the Wind?
Unfortunately, yes. I think people just need to take a step back. In fact, I think someone else sort of wrote a follow-up to the NPR saying, you know, let's put on our big boy britches here. And Gone with the Wind is a story of the Civil War in the South. Slavery existed. At the same time, Gone with the Wind is a work of fiction that was pretty much written in the 20s, the movie, of course, made in the 30s. Obviously, racial attitudes were different at the time. I think everyone realizes that now, and you look back on so many different movies, put it in context.
Hi, Kendra. Sorry, go ahead, Jod. Yes, put it in context and really that it's a product of its time. Kendra, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sorry you had some technical issues, but you're here now. And you're the author of Vivian Leigh, An Intimate Portrait. I think what amazes me about Vivian Leigh and her role in Gone with the Wind is that she was a British actress. She was born in India, but she was playing a spoiled Southern belle, and she won an Oscar for it. What can you tell us about the role that she played in making Gone with the Wind the much-loved epic that it is? No, Kendra?
Okay, so John, would you mind taking that question?
Well, I absolutely. I think there was a great deal of doubt, especially in the South, when Vivian Leigh was announced as Scarlett O'Hara. But when the movie came out, she just did an absolutely incredible job. And I think it's quite ironic that she won her second Oscar for playing another Southern belle, Blanche DuBois in A Streetcar Named Desire.
Of course.
She was an incredibly beautiful woman and an incredibly gifted actress, and simply became Scarlett O'Hara. We know, if you're a movie fan, you know many, many actresses were tested or mentioned for the role. You cannot imagine today anyone other than Vivian Leigh playing Scarlett. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. And John, you've written about the Margaret Mitchell novel upon which the movie is based. What was the response to the book when it was released? And was the path to cinema screens a smooth one?
Well, our first book in 2011 was basically a biography of Margaret Mitchell's novel. And we sort of told the story of how the book was written, marketed, and then has continued up to this day. The new book is a collection of Margaret Mitchell's letters about the making of the film from her point of view. I think we're generally familiar with All Selznick Went Through, The Search for Scarlett, the cost overruns, that kind of thing. But this book, through her letters, gives her perspective on what she saw from Atlanta, what she did not want to be involved in the movie. She said she didn't have anything to do with the casting, the script, but as a polite Southern woman, she also always wanted to help the movie people when they asked questions. And so it's sort of a dichotomy, and it's very interesting as she develops from this very naive woman to a very headstrong businesswoman.
And Kendra, are you on with us now?
I am now. Hi.
That's great. Hi there. So, Kendra, what was the most surprising thing that you discovered during your research regarding Vivian Leigh and the making of Gone with the Wind?
Well, when I was researching the book, I wasn't really expecting to find any, you know, big revelations because people have written about her life before. But regarding Gone with the Wind, I mean, it's just really interesting to know about how she felt about making it and the sort of stress that she was under when she was making it, because it was really, really a stressful shoot for her. I mean, David Selznick kind of prevented her and Laurence Olivier from living together, for example, and he was the reason why she came out there in the first place. And so it was just, you know, she was working 12-hour days and wasn't getting a lot of sleep and was in charge of this whole entire film, basically. And she really had to, you know, be the one to carry it. And so it was really difficult for her.
Hey, Kendra, this is Will McKinley in New York. Hey, so as you probably know, Gone with the Wind is getting a national re-release tomorrow and Wednesday from TCM and Fathom Events. Is the opportunity to see the film in a theater important to preserving the film's legacy?
I think so, because when you watch it on TV or on a DVD or on a laptop or something like that, it's a lot different from seeing it on the big screen. I think Gone with the Wind, like Lawrence of Arabia and all of those big epics, were really meant to be seen in the cinema. So when you watch it, you're sort of forced to pay attention. You're forced to notice the little details to really absorb the story. And then, of course, seeing it with a big audience makes such a difference. So, I really do think it is quite integral to preserving it for future generations.
Great. And John, can you tell us about the re-release history of Gone with the Wind? Is this the first major re-release of the film?
Oh, no. Gone with the Wind was re-released many, many times. Of course, it came out in 1939, opened generally across the country in early 1940. It was re-released in 1941, 1942, 1943, 1947, 1954, 1961, 1967, 1968, 1974, and then just off and on over the decades since. And I totally agree with Kendra. If you've never seen the film on a big screen, please go out tomorrow or Wednesday and see it.
Yes, that is very exciting, and if I was there, I would. I hope that both of you will get the chance to enjoy it on the big screen, but I wonder, John, you've written now two books about this particular topic, and it seems as if the interest doesn't wane. I suspect we'll be talking about Gone with the Wind long into the future, but why is that? What's the enduring element that makes us so crazy for it?
I think the bottom line, both the book and, of course, the film, is the story. These people created by Margaret Mitchell, but developed and brought on screen by David O. Selznick, seem like real people. You care about them. You live with them through these 12 years of the story. And that ending, which is open-ended, keeps you talking about them and feeling like they are real people, and you wonder what happened.
And Kendra, let me follow up with on a question that I asked John while you were in the ether. you may have heard about the NPR piece this week about how Gone with the Wind is aging. Do you feel like the film has fallen out of fashion because of issues of content?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, I totally get why people would find some of the content contentious and why people really like to study the race aspect especially. However, I don't think that's why so many people continue to love the film. I mean, as John said, it really is the story. I mean, it's the story of Scarlett O'Hara. Yes, there are some things that haven't aged well about it, particularly the characterization of the slaves in the film. But when you watch the film, I mean, you just get so absorbed into this story. I mean, people call it a romance, and it kind of is, you know, but just these characters that Margaret Mitchell created are so three-dimensional, I think, and a lot of times you don't see that in films even today. It's just something, the whole grandeur of the story, the historical intricacy of it, and even when you watch it today, I think with all the restorations and everything, you can see now, if you watch it on the big screen, elements that make it filmic. You know, you can see, for example, some of the hair pieces that Vivian Leigh wears, or that she had, like, pimples on her cheeks. Well, of course, she was 25 when she made the film, so it kind of makes it a little bit more real in that aspect, and not so Hollywood. And I think that has an appeal as well, because you're sort of, like, sucked into it, and you can kind of relate a little bit more. But I just think that it's got so many enduring qualities, and people, no matter where you live or what circumstances you've gone through, you can relate to that story or Scarlett's struggle or the things she does that aren't so nice in some way. So the characters are still relatable.
I agree. And John and Kendra, you've been very generous with us, and I understand we have signed copies of your books coming up at the end of the show. And we're going to be posting information about how listeners can find you and your books later on. I want to thank you for joining us for the Gone with the Wind epic part of the show, and for letting us hear your side of this sweeping romance. Thank you, John and Kendra.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Our final guest in the time machine is senior writer producer for Turner Classic Movies, Scott McGee. Scott, you're on? And,
I am.
And
hey,
you are calling, and you are calling from Atlanta, which is pretty much where our hearts just were.
Absolutely. Gone with the Wind is, it's woven into the fabric of living in Georgia.
How wonderful. Go ahead, sorry, you've grown up?
Yeah, I grew up here in Georgia, and it was Gone with the Wind was always a staple, starting even in grade school. I mean, it was whenever we would study the Civil War in grade school, the teacher would invariably always have a sick day, and so he or she would put on Gone with the Wind to cover that part of the Civil War.
Oh, that's terrific. Well, you know, one of the great tragedies of my life as I live so far away from where you are and everyone is that I don't get the chance to really watch TCM in the same way that everyone else does. How long have you been at TCM, and what do you do there exactly?
I've been with TCM for 14 years, and I started for the majority of that time working in the on-air promotions department, making a lot of the promos and interstitials that run in between the movies. As well as a lot of the celebrated TCM Remembers pieces that air at the end of the year.
Yes.
I left that department last year to work in programming and in the studio production units. I helped our senior programmer, Charlie Tabish, program a lot of the off-channel events, such as the festival, the TCM Classic Film Festival, and the cruise. And on the production side, I produce a lot of the on-air segments that involve a lot of our celebrity guests, primarily our Friday Night Spotlight franchise.
Which we've all been enjoying. Scott, this is Will in New York. We've all been enjoying the Pre-Code Festival this month, so thank you for that.
Well, that was actually not even mine. That was, I think it was Gary Friedman who produced that one. And it's good to hear from you, Will.
Well, so Scott, when you started at the channel, we'll say roughly 15 years or so ago, the fans' experience with TCM kind of went in one direction. And since roughly 2010 or so, TCM has been extending the experience with these off-channel experiences that you mentioned, which give fans an opportunity to interact with the brand and with other fans. An example, of course, is the Gone with the Wind screening. So what changed, and is it working?
I think it's working wholeheartedly. It's been kind of a perfect storm for TCM and for the fans. Not only did we, make this adjustment, this strategic change in really putting more emphasis on off-channel events such as the festival and the cruise and the bus tour and Fathom events, but also it went hand in hand, almost serendipitously, with the explosion of social media. With people who were able to share and revel together in their love of classic movies via Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, many things that you and Alicia are very much familiar with. So it was sort of a natural evolution, and I can't be more happy. I mean, a lot of the people at TCM are just over the moon with how things have happened.
Well, and I know I speak for the fans when I say that we feel a special kinship with all of you who work at TCM, and not just because we're jealous of your jobs, but because it's clear that you guys love what you do. And there has been a lot of press in the last month or so about potential layoffs and buyouts at Turner. Can fans expect TCM and the TCM Film Festival to continue in the manner that we love so much?
Before I answer that, let me just say that, you know, that kinship, we are very, very, we jealously guard that kinship. We're very mindful of how important it is and how precious and rare that it is to have that relationship with fans with a television network. It just doesn't happen all that often. And so we are very mindful and responsible that this is something that, you know, it needs to be cared for. And so we're very thankful for that.
And if I was on the cruise, yeah, go ahead, Scott. I was just going to say, if I was on the cruise, what would I experience? The TCM cruise, which I understand launches in just a few weeks' time.
What you would experience is a round-the-clock, it's nirvana.
Right.
You would have screenings that would start as early as 8:30 in the morning.
Wow.
You would have not just films, but you would also have events such as, you know, things that you would do with Robert, things that you would do with Ben. We also have mm-hmm. Eddie Muller on the cruise, Ileana Douglas. We will have Bruce Goldstein doing his celebrated presentation of The Tingler. We'll have a film noir theme night where we'll have dancing and everybody will be, you know, encouraged to dress up as their favorite femme fatale and Private Dick. It's just an endless celebration of movies, and it's something that I hope everybody will be able to experience.
And I've not been on the cruise, but I have been, as you know, to the TCM Film Festival every year, and I will continue to come every year that you do it. But can you just confirm for us that there will be a festival next year?
I will confirm that there will be a festival. I can't say when the dates will be announced, but hopefully we'll hear something very soon.
Excellent.
And you know, as far as your other question about, you know, layoffs, you know, everybody at TCM is very optimistic. I think our parent company recognizes that TCM is a very valuable jewel in the portfolio, if you will. So we're all optimistic that things will stay relatively okay. But again, to coin a phrase from William Goldman, no one really mm-hmm. knows anything. So we're just kind of hoping for the best.
And just a note to anybody who may be listening from the executive offices, if anything happens to TCM, you will have people with torches and pitchforks outside your door. So let's just make sure
True.
That's understood.
And flaming nitrate.
Right. Flaming nitrate film cans, courtesy of
yes.
Australian Film Collectors. So now it's time for the plug, Scott. Gone with the Wind from TCM, Fathom Events, and Warner Brothers Home Entertainment will be in theaters nationwide September 28th and October 1st at 2 and 7 p.m. local time. The film will also air on Turner Classic Movies on Monday, September 29th at 10 p.m. Eastern, and it will be available on demand via the Watch TCM streaming app from September 30th through October 6th. Scott McGee, thank you so much for joining us and for being frank with your answers and being such a generally cool dude.
Thank you. Thank you, Will. And thank you, Alicia, for having me on.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
This is the moment we've all been waiting for, free stuff. Our guests have been kind enough to provide an enormous amount of swag for us. In fact, I really can't even list it, and some of it we may not get time to. And it'll end up going onto our Facebook page where you can all fall on it like ravenous vultures then, and I will have to try and pretend that I'm there too. But you're going to have to work for this. Now, Will, what are we going to do next? What's
okay,
happening?
So here's the way this is going to work. We're going to open up the phone lines. When you call, please make sure to turn down your speakers. Second, tell us your first name and where you're calling from. And third, if you get a busy signal, hang up and call back. Okay, so here's the phone number. The phone number is 818-602-4929. We'll take the first caller. Our first giveaway is a signed copy of The Scarlet Letters, the making of the film Gone with the Wind by John Wiley Jr. And that's from Taylor Trade Publishing, and the book is signed by the author. Again, the number is 818-602-4929. Operators are standing by, ready to give away Gone with the Wind books. So call in, folks, and you'll get a book.
And if they don't call in, and if we get wrapped up, because I know that the studio is nearly wrapping up with us, we may need to move the whole picnic basket off to the Facebook page.
Oh, we have a caller. We have a caller.
Right? Hello. Go right ahead.
Hello, caller.
Hi, this is Mary from Illinois.
Hey, Mary from Illinois. You are the lucky winner of the Gone with the Wind book. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you. Wonderful.
All right, and connect
with
us
on the Facebook page.
Connect with us on social media, and we'll get that to you. And we also have many other prizes that we'll be presenting to you on the Facebook page. Since the clock on the wall indicates that it is time for us to go, sadly, it's been a fun show, Alicia. Thank you so much for having me. And remember, listeners. Exactly. Remember, listeners, you can connect with the Hollywood Time Machine on the web at aliciamayershow.com and also on Facebook. And make sure you follow Time Machine Talk and Real Alicia Mayer on Twitter. And I'm Will McKinley. That's at Will McKinley on Twitter. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.
Thank you all.
Listening to Hollywood Time Machine with Alicia Mayer, right here on LA Talk Radio.